loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, on Wednesday of this week, federal court judge Emmett Sullivan issued new orders demanding that the Mueller investigation provide to the judge, who's overseeing the sentencing of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, FBI memoranda and other documentation held by the FBI regarding how and why the FBI initially interviewed Flynn on January 24, 2017. That was the day that Flynn reported to FBI agents about his discussions with the Russian ambassador in Washington in December 2016. Flynn ultimately pled guilty to one count of lying to the FBI about his discussions with the Russian in that meeting. We're going to talk about what the judge's order might mean for Michael Flynn and for the Mueller probe. Next, the FBI has raided the home of a government employee who apparently sent documents to congressional oversight committees showing fraud committed by the Clinton Foundation. Senator Chuck Grassley, an Iowa Republican who is a champion of whistleblowers, sent a letter to the FBI asking them to explain why the whistleblower should not be protected under federal statute. So far, Grassley has been ignored. Meanwhile, a congressional hearing on the foundation yesterday exploded as Republicans attacked their own witnesses for refusing to answer questions. Then, a 7-year-old girl has died of shock and dehydration after being detained by the Border Patrol in New Mexico. The girl and her father were taken into custody after crossing the border. She was not given any food or water, and 8 hours later, with a body temperature of 105.7 degrees, she began having seizures. She died shortly thereafter. And then the Senate last night, by a margin of 56 to 41, voted to end U.S. military assistance for Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen, the strongest showing yet of bipartisan defiance of President Trump's defense of the kingdom after the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Although dramatic, the vote is likely symbolic because House Speaker Paul Ryan is refusing to permit a similar vote in the House. Meanwhile, an agreement to end fighting in the crucial Yemeni port city of Hodeidah has raised hopes for peace in the country. And finally, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the Mueller investigation. On Wednesday of this week, federal court judge Emmett Sullivan issued new orders demanding that the Mueller investigation provide to the judge, who's overseeing the sentencing of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, FBI memoranda and other documentation held by the FBI regarding how and why the FBI initially interviewed Flynn on January 24, 2017. That was the day that Michael Flynn reported to FBI agents about his discussions with the Russian ambassador in Washington, D.C. in December 2016. Flynn ultimately pled guilty to one count of lying to the FBI about his discussions with the Russian in that meeting. We're going to talk about what the judge's order might mean for Michael Flynn and for the Mueller probe. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of the new book, The Plot to Control the World: How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you.
Dan, this is getting more and more complicated. So what exactly does this mean? What's the judge's point here?
I think what the judge is concerned about is that we do not, and he does not, have a clear idea of all the summaries of interviews that the FBI has on Flynn. And then, in fact, there's some indication that summaries were done months after the fact and might have, in fact, changed the content of what Flynn might or might not have said. So I think we're going to learn more about that and learn whether, in fact, the FBI might have cooked the books here.
Let's go back for our audience and try to help establish some of the key facts here. Michael Flynn became National Security Advisor when Trump became president January 20th, 2017. During the transition period, he talked to the Russian ambassador Kislyak in Washington, D.C. at the request, it seems, of Jared Kushner, asking the Russians not to support a vote in the UN Security Council that would have lambasted and denounced, condemned Israeli settlement building in the West Bank. That's why Flynn called the Russian ambassador. The Russians the next day said, no, we're going ahead with the vote. Now, the FBI, Peter Strzok, Andrew McCabe, had the transcripts of those discussions between Flynn and Kislyak. Andrew McCabe, who had overseen the investigation of Hillary Clinton and who was ultimately fired from the FBI right before he was due to retire, he calls Michael Flynn on the morning of January 24th and has a friendly discussion with him and says, hey, Michael, we'd like to have a couple of our guys come over and talk to you. Can you do that? He says, you don't need to have a lawyer. Don't have a lawyer. And Flynn says, sure, come on over. And then the two agents come over and they meet with Flynn and they have discussions with him, and they've decided in advance, because they have the transcripts of that phone call with the Russian ambassador, if Flynn says something that's not in conformity with the transcripts, they're going to actually use the exact words. This is in the these are in the FBI memorandum. They're going to use the exact words back to Flynn. And if Flynn doesn't say that he remembers it exactly that way, they're not going to confront him. In other words, they're just going to record.
And they trap him that way.
They trapped him.
Yeah, it's a trick.
They basically trapped him, and they wanted to have him be without a lawyer. And the FBI memos show that Flynn was in a jocular mood. That's their language. He was in a jocular, relaxed mood, which is what McCabe wanted him to be.
Yeah, because he had no idea it was a setup.
He had no idea it was a setup. He thought they were all on the same team because they had been talking about other FBI business, and then sort of McCabe sort of threw that in.
But that sounds familiar.
So then the FBI, Peter Stroke, now disgraced, and his paramour, Lisa Page, who's the general counsel in Andrew McCabe's office, they're texting back and forth. Can we launch the 302? Can we send it about that meeting where they set up Michael Flynn? And Lisa Page says, launch the 302. Okay, there's the 302. That's the memorandum. That's the name of the memorandum, the filing that the FBI has to make. But in the final iteration of this, the 302 memorandum is not submitted as of January or February 2017, but August 22nd, 2017, after Peter Stroke has been removed for abuse and misconduct by Mueller from the probe. So Judge Emmett Sullivan here in Washington, D.C., the same judge who threw out the government's case, Mueller's case against Republican Senator Ted Stevens from Alaska, because the FBI had refused to do what it legally must do, which is to provide the defense at that time with exculpatory information that would have been beneficial to the defense. Because they didn't do that, this judge, Emmett Sullivan, very well-known judge, I've been in his courtroom, he said that case is thrown out. That's what happened to Mueller's case against Ted Stevens. Now he's demanding that Mueller come forward and give him all of these documents, all of the possible different iterations of that one memorandum, and to do it by today because Mike Flynn is about to be sentenced on the 18th. This sounds to me like something that we didn't fully expect. I certainly didn't, Dan. And Judge Sullivan's a tough guy. He's a straight shooter.
Yeah, well, again, I think he smells a rat and is concerned that Flynn was set up, and again, that summaries might have been changed to make things look worse for Flynn than they were. And if I might say something, if we think at least for a moment on the substance of what Flynn did, that he met with a Russian ambassador during the transition period, that means after Trump was elected but before he was sworn in, this is a very common practice of the incoming administration. They will start meeting with foreign ambassadors to prepare to take office. So the fact that Flynn met with the ambassador, Kislyak, there was nothing wrong with that in and of itself. And so all they could try to get him on was somehow misrepresenting that meeting or the fact of the meeting. And it seems like they went out of their way to try to do that.
And I don't think Flynn, and we're no fans of Mike Flynn.
No,
I
certainly
mean,
not.
Not at all. And we're no fans of Donald Trump, not at all. But again, if we have Andrew McCabe and Peter Stroke, who are clearly biased against Trump and are trying to entrap the national security advisor, Mike Flynn, 4 days after Trump takes office, I mean, they could have said to Mike Flynn, you know, we actually know exactly what you said to the Russian ambassador. Clearly, it's as Dan is saying, it's not illegal to talk. We know exactly what you said, and you're not saying it exactly right. Do you want to change your story? Flynn could have said, oh, yeah, you're actually right. Those are my exact words. But they didn't do that because their goal was not to set the record straight. They knew what the record was. They had the transcripts. They had the intelligence logs, the verbatim intelligence logs. That wasn't the goal. The goal was to set Flynn up, and they did it.
That's what they do.
And Flynn was fired, and now Flynn had to plead guilty to one count. And Mueller's not even asking for big time for Flynn, right?
I mean, in fact, he's not asking for any time for Flynn.
So it was for headlines.
Sure.
It was for headlines.
Sure, it was sensationalism.
Because he hasn't shown anything yet, a Mueller can get these convictions like a Flynn for lying to the FBI about a meeting with a Russian, which was not an illegal meeting, and they set him up.
And then you've got this guy, Flynn, who was a three-star general, who was the national security advisor of the United States. He was probably going on to great wealth in his retirement, and now his life is wrecked. Now he has a felony conviction. He can't get a security clearance again. He's finished. And so what does a guy like that do? He flips immediately and he begs Mueller to at least not send him to prison. That's exactly what Mueller wanted to happen. He knew it was a setup from the beginning. He probably ordered the FBI to set him up. And now he has Flynn begging for help.
Well, the person who appears to have set it up, Dan, we have 1 minute left, James Comey on MSNBC, said that he wouldn't have ever been able to get away with this in the Obama administration or the George W. Bush because they were, quote, organized, but the Trump administration was disorganized because, of course, Trump really didn't ever expect to become president. And he was bragging on TV, on MSNBC, Comey was, that he couldn't have just walked into the White House and had FBI agents interviewing a senior White House official. There would have been a very long, complicated process before that kind of interview could happen. But he just had McCabe call Flynn up and say, hey, can we come over? Can we talk? Flynn says, yeah. He says, don't bring a lawyer. Flynn says, sure. And then they got him. That's what happened.
Yeah, well, again, whether we like Flynn or not, we don't like Flynn. The fact is, it seems to me his rights were violated. If they were really thought he was guilty of some crime and they were investigating it, he should have been read his rights. He should have been told what they were planning to charge him with. And he should have been told he had a right to a lawyer instead of being told, don't bring a lawyer. This should be, again, very concern to people who care about due process, who care about the rule of law. And here the rule of law was violated.
That's it. Well, that was the voice of Dan Kovalik, who joined us from Pittsburgh. Dan's a human rights and labor lawyer, who is the author of the new book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. We were happy to have him. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The FBI has raided the home of a government employee who apparently sent documents to congressional oversight committees showing fraud committed by the Clinton Foundation. Senator Chuck Grassley, an Iowa Republican who is a champion of whistleblowers, sent a letter to the FBI asking them to explain why the whistleblower should not be protected under federal statute. So far, Grassley has been ignored. Meanwhile, a congressional hearing on the foundation yesterday exploded as Republicans attacked their own witnesses for refusing to answer questions. We're joined from Paris by Brad Birkenfeld. He's a famed whistleblower who single-handedly brought down international money laundering at banking giant UBS. Brad, welcome back.
John, thank you for having me. And Brian, thank you. Hope you gentlemen are doing well today.
Thank you, Brad. Say, Brad, it's actually tough to find news on this issue. You have to go out there and search for it. It appears on a handful of alternative sites. There was a sentence or two from Fox News, and of all people, Rush Limbaugh talked about it on his show yesterday. But it's hard to find news about the Clinton Foundation. There actually is a federal investigation. There's a separate congressional investigation. And now we know that there is a whistleblower involved. Can you tell us what's happening with the Clinton Foundation?
Well, it's quite interesting. There's a lot of information that's not being disseminated, and I think this is really a travesty. When I was at UBS, of course, there was a lot of clients who had illegal offshore money that were actually giving donations to the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton campaign. So there's a real conflict of interest here and a lot of illegal impropriety placed. And I mentioned this years ago, and I was pretty much rebuked on that. So it's quite troubling.
So, Brad, in your own experience, tell us a little bit about what it's like when you go to the authorities. You go through the chain of command. This is something that I didn't do in my own whistleblowing experience, but this is something that we're all taught to do. You go through your chain of command when you see evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, or you go to the congressional oversight committees. Apparently, that's what this whistleblower did, and things aren't working out for him.
Well, That's an interesting approach, of course. Now, I was in the corporate side of the business, not on the government side. So there's a little bit of a difference there, and I think that has to be clarified. But beyond that, I think whistleblowers in general do go up the chain of command, whatever that chain of command is. I did go up to my legal and compliance departments, and they refused to answer me for several months. Ultimately, I resigned from the bank in Switzerland, and then I brought my complaint to the board of directors of UBS in Zurich. And I didn't have to because I was already out of the bank, but I felt it was important to do so. When that fell through and they covered it up even further, that's when I got quite upset, and I took my complaints right to the U.S. government and went to many agencies in Washington, D.C., which led to the huge exposure of this multi-billion dollar illegal tax scheme.
What we're talking about here is a guy inside, apparently inside the Clinton Foundation. We don't know, frankly. I'm assuming. He found evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, and he went directly to a watchdog group. From the watchdog group, he sent these documents to the Congressional Oversight Committees showing that fraud had been committed. What happened next is typical of what happens to whistleblowers. The FBI raids the guy's house, and they arrest him for possessing government documents. Now, they're alleging that he stole these documents. Now, you can't steal documents if the purpose of taking them is to send them to the Congressional Oversight Committees. But the FBI so far is refusing to respond to Senator Grassley. What happens next in a case like this?
Well, I think the first thing is, you know, the FBI is suspect here. The biggest problem here is that they're part of the problem, not part of the solution. And I think that, for your audience, has to be clear. The second thing here is, and they have a long history of screwing up cases, destroying evidence, lying under oath, and so on and so forth. So that's the environment we're in with this agency called the FBI under the Department of Justice. But more importantly, this person has gone out of his way to actually not only risk his career, but also to expose what was going on. If there was something really illegal about him holding these documents, why would he go to his own congressional committees that have oversight in this issue? That's the real crux of the question here. And I think the problem here is that obviously they're being exposed for covering it up. That's really what we're getting down to, and that's where hopefully the congressional committees will get to the bottom of this, because this is really outrageous.
You know, there's something else going on, too. It's another component of this story that is just simply not being reported. There were congressional hearings yesterday on the House side. This is Representative Mark Meadows, a Republican of North Carolina, who's the chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Subcommittee of the Government Operations Committee. This is a very important investigative body in the House of Representatives. He said something yesterday to Fox News that is so important, and nobody's talking about it. He said that in the last week, three people have come forward with hundreds of pages of documents that are evidence of wrongdoing by the Clinton Foundation, including misappropriation of funds and allegations of quid pro quo promises made to donors as part of a pay-for-play scandal. So we have the possibility of a major felony investigation, and nobody's talking about it.
Well, the problem I see here is it's very simple. There's a lot of people that have information that need to come forward with respect to the transgressions committed by the Clinton Foundation. We don't want to accuse them of wrongdoing at this time, but there's certainly enough evidence of impropriety and transgressions. But why isn't anyone investigating it? Instead, they're trying to quell the whistleblowers, hide the evidence, and not pursue this through the proper investigative channels. This is very, very serious.
What advice would you give to these whistleblowers or would-be whistleblowers? Now, this is going to be a very controversial case. It's already a controversial investigation. It's partisan, I suppose, by its very nature. So what would you tell these whistleblowers?
Well, first, I'd say to get good legal counsel. And certainly in Washington, there's many firms and certainly whistleblower experts in this area of legal advice. That's the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do is make sure that their own senator and senators are informed of this information in writing, So you paper the file, as we say. That way, no one can come back and say, I wasn't informed, I wasn't told. And the true intent of the whistleblower was to expose the waste, fraud, and corruption that they witnessed. So I think that's really the key to this here. And I think anyone who comes forward should certainly follow those straightforward guidelines.
Yeah, amen to that. You know, this is something I think that it's a lesson that we have to learn over and over and over again. It's either that the collective memory is so short, or people just don't know what their rights are and what their responsibilities are, and that it's the whistleblowers who should be the norm, not the exception. It should be that when people see waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, that they should come forward. Now, the problem here also is the FBI. I have to agree with you that it's the FBI that are the bad guys here. The FBI shouldn't be arresting or targeting the whistleblower.
Well, this is exactly it. I mean, if they were such super sleuths and great detectives, they would have uncovered this. Where have they been for the last 10 years?
And where have the auditors been? You're right.
Yes, exactly. So let's indict the FBI and put some of these people on trial. Don't give me this, they've got immunity and so forth. No, they don't. They've acted outside their responsibility. They're also the Constitution they have violated. They've betrayed the American people, and people are fed up. And now it's time that we get some answers. And I think if you go in and see the recent article in the Epoch Times by Seamus Bruner on December 5th, you'll see the Clinton Foundation pay-to-play model is all under investigation. I mean, this is not a one-off. This is decades of abuse in multiple areas. And I witnessed it at UBS. And I told the DOJ about this, and they did nothing.
Another thing, too, that nobody is talking about is this is not new information. We know from WikiLeaks that this went on for years. And we knew from the cache of State Department documents released by Chelsea Manning that the Clinton Foundation was a pay-for-play operation years ago, and nobody did anything about it.
Well, that's precisely it, John. And let me tell you something. I personally have met with Julian Assange twice in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And the first thing he said to me when I went in to see him, I'll never forget it, I gave him my book and he gave me his book, autographed. And I said, well why do you think Hillary Clinton had this server at home? He didn't even hesitate. The first thing out of his mouth was FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests, and she can avoid them because it's not on government property, it's on her personal property. She knew exactly what she was doing. Whether she claimed she doesn't know, really, of the former first lady who was a senator from New York, who then was running for president, can honestly try and tell us to our face that she didn't know what she was doing? That's a fraud. Absolute fraud.
Yeah, I have to agree. I think this is something that we should all be worried about because it undermines our democracy. Well, we will leave it there. We were very pleased to be joined from Paris by Brad Birkenfeld. Brad is a famed whistleblower who literally single-handedly brought down international money laundering at the banking giant UBS. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A 7-year-old girl has died of shock and dehydration after being detained by the Border Patrol in New Mexico. The girl and her father were taken into custody after crossing the border. She was not given any food or water, and 8 hours later, with a body temperature of 105.7 degrees, she began having seizures, and she died shortly thereafter. We're joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Juan Jose, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Juan Jose, I was appalled to see a statement by the Border Patrol this morning saying that they were offering their sincere condolences to the family. This should never, ever happen. There is a standard procedure that when an immigrant is detained, they are given a medical checkup and they are given food and water, and this did not happen in this case. What can you tell us about it?
Well, the first thing that needs to be said is that this is, without a doubt, a tragedy that should have never happened. But this tragedy is the direct result of a culture of cruelty on the part of immigration authorities directed against undocumented workers. But it is especially exacerbated over the last 3 years by the racist anti-immigrant policies under the Donald Trump administration coming out of the White House. And so, you know, these sort of tragedies are not unique. I'm sure that there must be other children that have lost their lives that we don't know about. As you mentioned in the introduction, it took a full week for the immigration authorities to acknowledge the loss of this child. And so we need to hold the Donald Trump administration accountable, as well as the immigration authorities.
I agree. This is an appalling, terrible event. Brian and I were talking about it before the show, and I really want to know if someone's going to be charged with manslaughter, with depraved indifference. I mean, a child is dead. A child is dead because of neglect, and there has to be a price to pay for that.
Well, I hope you're right, John. It must be said that this is, without a doubt, a flagrant human rights violation of U.S. immigration law, and of course, of international law as well. I mean, the United States, a country of immigrants, a country that prides itself on building the most powerful economy of the world, on the labor of immigrants from all over the world, has no moral or legal justification for having children crossing with their parents from Mexico into the United States in dangerous areas as a direct result of the immigration policies that are being pursued by the Donald Trump administration. This child, this 7-year-old Guatemalan girl, crossed into the United States in a desert area. She suffered dehydration and shock, as you mentioned, and she died. The Donald Trump administration is indirectly responsible for this death. And even though they're not the ones directly involved, I'm talking about the Donald Trump administration for enforcing laws along the physical U.S.-Mexico border, they do establish the policies that make it policy for the, you know, for the U.S. Border Patrol to exist in this culture of cruelty against undocumented immigrants, including children. So this is appalling, un-American, it's racist, and they need to be held accountable. I agree.
She was walking with her dad through the desert.
Through the desert.
They didn't have food. They didn't have water. When she came into custody, she was obviously in need. I think I'm right, John, right, that they did not give her water. They did not give her food.
They did not give her water or food. And
for like a long time.
Yeah, for 8.5 hours that she was in their custody. But as it turned out, she also had no food or water for at least 2 days before arriving.
Yeah.
But that's not supposed to happen, because the first thing that they should ask is, when did you last eat or drink? And as they give them medical exams at the border, they're supposed to provide food and water immediately. And they didn't.
And we have other images over the years, even recent years, not just during the Trump years, though, of Border Patrol like taking water that's been left out in the desert and emptying it so that, you know, when these people who are dying, literally dying of thirst, come to places where other humanitarian groups or humane people have left water or some supplies, the Border Patrol actually seeks those things out and then destroys them so that people don't have water. It's a policy, actually. I mean, I don't know if it's a policy. It's a practice.
It's a practice. It happens all the time.
Something that also needs to be noted in this tragedy is that Border Patrol agents offer as another excuse for why this tragedy happened, the fact that the detention centers that they operate were built to hold basically adult unaccompanied males. But over the years, that has happened. And so they're basically requesting, you know, that Congress provide them with additional funds so that they can have better facilities where they can hold parents and children together, right, under the new policies that are in place right now. So their solution, you know, is to continue this cruel immigration enforcement's policies instead of thinking about this as a human crisis that needs a different type of approach than what we've been seeing up until now. And so, you know, that's part of the tragedy that's going to continue to inform us about not just the death of this child, but about the generalized violation of human rights for the many immigrants that are escaping poverty, crime, lack of opportunity, jobs, and so on, and coming to America, who's directly responsible for the economic conditions and the crime that's rampant in their nations that's forcing them to come up north.
Juan Jose Gutierrez is our guest. Juan Jose is the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition in Los Angeles. We're talking about the death of a little girl, a girl who died because of criminal negligence at the minimum. But I'm looking at Newsweek from 6 months ago. I want to read the headline to you, John and Juan Jose, and then read a couple sentences and then get Juan Jose's reaction. Border Patrol kicked, punched migrant children, threatened some with sexual abuse, ACLU alleges. And here's the first couple sentences. Migrant children under the care of the United States Customs and Border Protection, CBP, were allegedly beaten, threatened with sexual violence, and repeatedly assaulted while in custody between 2009 and 2014. This is before Trump. This is during the Obama era. According to a report released Wednesday, this is back in May, from the American Civil Liberties Union and the International Human Rights Clinic at the University of Chicago Law School, based on 30,000 pages of documents obtained through a records request, the report includes gruesome, detailed accusations of physical and mental abuse at the hands of officers. This is 6 months ago. This is a story about what was going on by these same Border Patrol officials and officers between the years 2009, 2014. I think you called it the culture of cruelty, Juan Jose.
May I add something to that, too? I'm going to make a generalization. I'm probably going to take some flack for this from some of our listeners, but I'm going to say it anyway because I know these people. It was my experience when I was in government that Border Patrol agents were just like prison guards. They were the scraps of society. They were guys who were drummed out of the military. They were guys who couldn't make it through the local police academy, but they had this thing about law enforcement, quote unquote, and they became border guards. All you need to have to be a border guard is a high school diploma or a GED and no felony convictions. That's it. They don't make any money. And it's because the Border Patrol can't find decent people. And so they end up with people like this who ignore the needs of human beings, who allow children to die of dehydration, and we have nothing but problem after problem on the border, and it's the government's fault.
We have to say this too. When the issue of immigration became a technique for right-wing politicians to win votes, they started coming up with these formulas that the only way to control unregulated, undocumented migration into the United States was to simply throw money at the Border Patrol and the overall immigration service and hire thousands upon thousands of people. I think we have currently a police force of about 20,000 immigration officers. And as you said, as the pressure built up to hire more and more immigration officers, a job that not many people desire to perform, what the system has become is one plague with unqualified, perhaps mentally unstable individuals that embrace this culture of cruelty, and they feel that they have a free hand to basically do anything that they want against undocumented immigrants, including children. And the results are there, glaring all of us in a situation where tragedies and abuse, rampant abuse, I would say, is happening daily. This is just one instance where we are being informed that the 7-year-old Guatemalan girl unnecessarily and cruelly lost her life. But I can tell you that just as Brian mentioned right now, there is a culture of generalized abuse that includes sexual abuse, beatings, you know, mental abuse. I mean, you name it. And this is something that's been going on for many, many years.
That's right. And we need to be more attuned to what's happening down there on the border. Well, that was the voice of Juan Jose Gutierrez, who joined us from Los Angeles. He's the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Senate last night, by a margin of 56 to 41, voted to end U.S. military assistance for Saudi Arabia's war against Yemen in the strongest showing yet of bipartisan defiance of President Trump's defense of the kingdom after the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Although dramatic, the vote is largely symbolic because House Speaker Paul Ryan is refusing to permit a similar vote in the House. Meanwhile, an agreement to end fighting in the crucial Yemeni port city of Hodeidah has raised hopes for peace in the country. We're joined from Chicago by Kathy Kelly. She's co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Welcome back, Kathy.
Thank you, John and Brian.
So, Kathy, good news, bad news, indifferent news. How should we be looking at this?
Well, I think in terms of 87,500 children who've starved to death in this war, it certainly is something that's come, you know, too late for many. And yet this is, I believe, a pointer, an indicator that messages are now being sent, much clearer messaging than had been sent before, about the frustration and the anger over the slaughter of children in Yemen, over the support for warring parties in Yemen. And so I think the combination of the Senate vote, the fact that in 3 weeks a Democratic Congress will be in power, and the very, very important negotiations over the port city of Hodeidah, and also briefing the United Nations today, seeking a new United Nations resolution, is Mr. Mark Lowcock of the UNICEF. And so I think, you know, it certainly is clear that many, many more people are aware of and alarmed by and really sorrowful over the killing of so many people in Yemen. And I can't urge strongly enough that people look at the New York Times Sunday magazine cover story with photos, again, from Tyler Hicks and a fellow named Jeffrey Stern has written an article which traces the manufacture of the weapons in the United States and then also goes into excruciating detail about what happens in a small remote village in Yemen when just completely out of the blue, as far as the villagers were concerned, they were celebrating the installation of a well, and all of a sudden they were hit. And the torture that's caused by those kinds of attacks made possible by U.S. weapons.
We're speaking with Kathy Kelly, the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. We're speaking with her about Yemen. Kathy, I have another question. It's more U.S. Political question than anything else. This vote, 56 to 41, was a very pleasant surprise, and it shows that people like Lindsey Graham and Bob Corker are serious about challenging the president on his Yemen policy. But 56 votes aren't enough to override a veto. I'm confident, as you are, that once the Democrats take control of the House in a few weeks, a Yemen vote will be forthcoming there as well. But that, too, probably won't be enough to override a veto. Do you think we can get to that point eventually? Do you think we're going to arrive finally at a position where we can really force the president's hand and have a real effect in Yemen?
Well, I think that the war in Yemen has everything to do with greedy land grabs on the part of strong corporate interests and with continued weapons sales that satisfy corporate interests. So we should be careful not to assign just a handful of bad guys. It's easy to do, you know, because I think that President Trump and Mohammed bin Salman and Mohammed bin Zayed, that's the fellow, the prince over in the United Arab Emirates, these are people who have done tremendous wrong to many, many, many innocent people. But there's a much wider constellation that we must keep in mind, and that's what carries a great deal of lobbying power in Washington, D.C. But it's also the case that, you know, so unlike sanctions against Iraq, which were done in darkness and it's almost like a total eclipse of any awareness, this time it's different. There are other powerful forces, including the mainstream media, that are paying attention. But there's also a grassroots movement going on across this country that's pretty steadfastly communicating that they don't want to continue having any part in this war or in the starvation and the possible famine. Now, meanwhile, you know, the suffering goes on intensely. And there's, you know, the Port of Hodeida hopefully will open up and this humanitarian line will open up and a line into the second city, Taiz, sorry, the third largest city, Taiz, will open up. These are all very important measures, but the hospital system has collapsed. The education system has collapsed. Transportation systems have collapsed. So it's extremely important in these follow-up crucial days that resolutions get passed that have some teeth and name the warring parties within the United Nations, but also that all of the groups that are assisting with humanitarian relief be given all possible help and that the warring parties be held to these agreements. It's a very fragile.
That's the voice of Kathy Kelly. She is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Kathy, I was struck today when I picked up the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. Both papers had above the fold in their hard copy very large photos. They were different photos, but they were of the same scene. And the photos were of, as they captioned it, I'm paraphrasing, Houthi rebels line up to support the peace process. You know, I've never seen a picture of people, the Houthis. They're sort of this mystical force in American mainstream media. But they look like human beings.
Yeah, imagine.
They look like ordinary folks. Like if the media wants to humanize people instead of just treating them with a mystique or in a demonized way, it can. And it seemed to me both papers were actually trying to do that, which would signify, it seemed to me, something of a shift, at least in their own coverage. And it comes, of course, the day after this Senate vote. Anyway, your comments on all that.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad that you mentioned that. One thing I noticed is in the picture that appeared on the front page of the New York Times, there's not an extra ounce of flesh on any one of those men and boys. Two of the people in that lineup are little boys. One looks like he's almost sound asleep standing up on his feet. They're wearing clothing that is you know, just the bare minimum, tattered sandals. And the reason I think it's important to discuss that is to compare the Saudi and UAE fighters and their weaponry and so much of that fighting being done through remote control or through assistance from very, very well-trained and well-heeled special operations forces from the United States. Now, it is true that the United Arab Emirates has hired fighters from Sudan, mercenaries who've come from various different countries, and they're probably experiencing the same impoverishment, really, as the Houthi rebels. But I think you're right. It's crucial that we try to see the individuals, see the human beings. And this time, I would say that the New York Times has certainly put the money into getting very talented reporters and photographers over to Yemen, and believe me, I know it cost a lot of money because it wasn't. Voices couldn't even think of trying a year ago to get visas and travel because you just would have to pay so much. You'd have to have very deep pockets to pay quite a lot of money to get across various checkpoints. But they've been over there now for back and forth for many months, and so will the U.S. public sit down and read and study and listen? That's also extremely important. You know, I think it's a complicated situation, but the more you get hooked, it is also extremely interesting, although it's horrific. But I think one thing we have to be careful of is not to fall for what we hear over and over and over again. This is a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and its longtime rival, Iran, and so the United States has to side with the Saudis. I don't believe it's a proxy war at all. I think it's a a greedy imperialist takeover war. And really, you know, you can't name Iran as one of the warring parties. There's just not the evidence. When President Trump says Iran has to withdraw first, how can it withdraw? It's not even officially named. And if they're supplying the men in the picture in the New York Times with the weapons, well, you know, it's really not a very big price tag on those rifles that these guys are holding.
Kathy, we've got 1 minute left, and I have to ask you if you are optimistic or pessimistic about further talks, whether they're in Stockholm or somewhere else. Now, what we've gotten is a ceasefire in Hodeida. Do you see this progressing? Do you think we can get to the point where there might be peace in Yemen?
I'm going to be even more optimistic. I think if people can begin to see this war in Yemen is wrongful and unnecessary, maybe we'll get to the point where people will point to every other war the United States is either involved in or bankrolling, and maybe we'll get to the point of challenging the weapon makers themselves. I think we should push as though there's no tomorrow.
Yeah, and of course, while this has happened in the Senate, it could be the people and should be the people and will be the people who actually make a difference. And, you know, there's that famous cliche that when one person is killed, it's a murder, but when millions are killed or thousands, it's just a statistic. And I think you have the Senate responding to the killing of a journalist. But every day, as Kathy is pointing out, there is the murder. We just have to call it what it is. The people are being killed. They're not just dying. They're being killed because of bullets and bombs and missiles, but also because of disease that's deliberately and hardship and lack of food and water deliberately imposed on them as a consequence of U.S. and Saudi policy. So the people, she's right. We, the people, have to do this.
She is right. It's some rare good news, I think. We were joined from Chicago by Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, and we're joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Steve and Nicole, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Delighted to join you.
So Bill Bloom died this week. I don't know if very many people know Bill Bloom outside of, you know, those of us on his mailing list or those of us who would run into him at political events every once in a while. I liked Bill a lot. He fell. He had a terrible accident in his home and died after suffering for a couple of months. Steve, talk about the headline associated with Bill's untimely death.
Okay. Well, this is from the New York Times, and it was just a clear attempt to smear a great man. The headline reads, William Bloom, U.S. policy critic cited by bin Laden, dies at 85. And what was the substance of this headline? Well, because bin Laden once said that Bill Bloom's book called Rogue State, which I happen to have a copy right here in my hand, would be, quote unquote, useful for you to read. My favorite response to this came from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who wrote their own article criticizing this editorial. They titled their article, William Bloom, U.S. policy critic derided by New York Times, dies at 85.
I was disappointed, too, that the Washington Post, I know that Bill's son approached the Post about an obituary, and the Post didn't even bother to write one.
I mean, his books, everybody should read his books.
They're outstanding, and they've withstood the test of time.
Yeah, Killing Hope, Rogue Nation. Bill Bloom was a friend. John, you knew him. I knew him well. We talked a lot. I talked to him about the fact that Osama bin Laden actually said people should read his book. And I said, Bill, it looks like as soon as Osama bin Laden mentioned your book went to the number one seller on whatever that was, Amazon. And I said, so have you become rich now? Sort of weirdly. And he said, no, it's actually really hurt me. He got many, he really lived because of college lectures and he was paid honorarium. All of that dried up simply because Osama bin Laden happened to have read his book and happened to have said he thought the book was an important read. And so Bill basically was semi-impoverished at the very end of his life as a consequence of this sort of gratuitous mention by Osama bin Laden of his book. So yes, sales, you know, knowledge, infamy raised the visibility on the book, and people started to look at the book and started to buy the book for a day or two. But then the demonization that he endured as a consequence was very, very harmful.
And he wasn't a young guy. It's not like he could just start over. When he died last week, he was 85 years old. So if you're going to be wrecked like that at the end of your life, there's no turning it around.
I didn't read the book. I'm actually not familiar with Bill Bloom. But would you, Brian, would you talk a little bit more about why, I mean, why bin Laden would have wanted people to read that? Like, what can you tell us more context about that?
He was saying, you know, there was the whole sort of demonization of Arab countries like Iraq as rogue nations or rogue states. Wherever the United States was targeting a government for overthrow, the U.S. propaganda machine went into full swing and said, these are rogue nations. Now, what does that mean? You're a rogue nation. It means you're sort of an outlaw nation. You're something that can be targeted. So Bill Bloom went through the history of all of the U.S. wars and occupations and invasions and interference in other countries of one means or another. And he was trying to demonstrate, if you're going to talk about a rogue nation, it's U.S. imperial policy and the U.S. imperial government that is a rogue nation. So when you have somebody like Osama bin Laden, he read the book. The book documents this long trail of U.S. criminal activity in parts of the world, including the Middle East. Osama bin Laden may have liked it. He said he liked it. He thought it was important. That's the only reason. He could have read Howard Zinn's book. He could have read books by Noam Chomsky. He could have read books by hundreds of authors who are also critics of U.S. foreign policy, especially in the Middle East. And yeah, Osama bin Laden might have thought some of them were useful for an English-speaking audience. But that's what happened to Bill Bloom.
There's a very interesting note in the FAIR article, which I'd like to mention. They point out that it was Bloom who first discovered the interview that was given by Zbigniew Brzezinski, which he gave in French to a French newspaper, which is why most people hadn't seen it, in which he talked about what's now called the Afghan trap, in which the U.S. funded bin Laden and the other Islamists in order to lure Russian troops into Afghanistan. So whereas most Americans have the idea that Russia invaded Afghanistan and then the U.S. kind of started funding these bin Laden and his crew to oppose the Russians, actually it was the opposite way around, and it was Bloom who was instrumental in discovering that interview by Brzezinski.
And Brzezinski meant that what Brzezinski was talking about was the CIA was conducting covert operations to overthrow the socialist government in Afghanistan that came to power in a coup in 1978. The Soviets came in 1979 to support their allies in Kabul, the socialist government. Brzezinski called that Russia's Vietnam, the Soviet Union's Vietnam, being bogged down in a war that they could not, quote, win. But you know what? I'm glad we're talking about it because Zbigniew Brzezinski and the Carter administration and then the Reagan administration that came afterwards was supporting Osama bin Laden because, yes, the Mujahideen and Osama bin Laden was a principal fundraiser for them. They were the guys who were fighting against the Soviet Union and against the socialist government in Afghanistan. At that time, everybody, America was all friendly with mm-hmm. Osama bin Laden. Things changed only in the 1990s.
It's kind of ironic. The two criticisms that the New York Times makes, to go back to the New York Times obituary, is that, first of all, Bloom did not disavow the bin Laden's recommendation that people should read his book. Like, he's going to tell people, no, my book isn't useful for you to read. Don't read it. And which is just bizarre.
It is.
Yeah. And also that he didn't express regret that bin Laden shared his disdain for U.S. foreign policy.
That's the kind of thought police that exists in the United States. We say we're a great democracy. It's a tyranny of thought police. If Osama bin Laden said you should read this book, and if Bill Bloom didn't get down on his knees and say, I reject Osama bin Laden, which of course he did, but he didn't get up and genuflect in public. And so they attack Bill Bloom for that. But really, they attack Bill Bloom because he really was a very, very effective critic of U.S. foreign policy.
And that's what made him so dangerous, quote unquote, is because he was able to talk truth to power all the way back to the 1960s. And that's why the government tried to convince people that he was somehow subversive, that he was dangerous. He was dangerous to the American way of life. He was friends with Philip Agee. They worked together. They wrote books together. And in the end, it was Bill Blum who was right.
He worked for the State Department and he got disillusioned because of the war in Vietnam. That's basically what happened.
Yeah, that was it.
I mean, that's the thing that's being described about Sputnik, about our show, right? That we're subversive, that we're, you know, spreading things to divide society, but we're reflecting the things that we actually see.
Before we move on to a different topic, I just want to add one more headline. This is from 25 years ago this week from The Independent, a British newspaper. And here's the headline: Anti-Soviet warrior puts his army on the road to peace. And who was that anti-Soviet warrior?
Oh my God.
I think you know.
Oh my God.
It was Osama bin Laden.
Perfect.
Wow.
So that's how Osama bin Laden was thought of 25 years ago.
Wow.
I'll tell you something too. When I first joined the CIA in 1990, it's a long time ago, the guy that I sat next to wrote a paper. We worked in this office that handled leadership analysis, and frankly, nobody cared what we wrote because none of it was important. So we had this internal office magazine where we could publish our one-page papers. And he wrote this paper in 1990, and he called Osama bin Laden the most dangerous man in the world. And it was seen as being so ridiculous, so preposterous, that he actually couldn't get it published even inside the CIA in an internal publication.
Wow. Steve, Pat, we have really run the clock down here because of the Bill Blum story, but I'm glad we talked about Bill and about the terrible headlines about him from the New York Times. But in our last little bit, where do we want to go next?
Well, here's an article from NPR, which really offended me, the headline: New Congresswoman will pay her interns $15 an hour. Is that a big deal? This is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, of course. And of course it's a big deal. What an offensive headline. Not only is she the fourth member, only the fourth member of Congress who's going to offer her interns $15 an hour, but she's the one who's been responsible for bringing it to national attention and opening up the possibility that congressional internship can now be, you know, served by people of all economic classes and strata, not just rich people who can afford to work for free. I mean, it's a hell of a big deal. And the fact that they even question that is just really offensive.
I couldn't agree more. I have plenty of, you know, friends and people who've tried to work on Capitol Hill, but you make almost no money. And I mean, it's nearly impossible to live in this expensive city without some kind of funding.
Isn't that the truth? Well, we'll leave it there. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Pat. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. And we were joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. She is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. La 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 la